Welcome to the Peak Performance Productivity Podcast, revealing what productive peak performers think, say, and do, so you too can be productive. With me, your host, Michael Tipper. Now, my guest today is a behavioral specialist with over 25 years of experience in the people development space. The author of two books, he is a prolific facilitator, speaker, and performance coach, and has worked in some of the toughest and most regulated industries in the world. He has majored on leadership development, focusing on the practical intersection of neuroscience and performance psychology to create a cutting-edge approach to working with teams and their leaders. A brilliant presenter and insightful facilitator, his ability to manage, engage, and stimulate learning with even the toughest of audiences is impressive, to say the least. I'm really excited about today's guest for two reasons. First, it's because of his depth of knowledge of neuroscience and the amount of preparation I know he will have done for today, even though I told him not to. But secondly, because I have personally worked with and alongside him for the last 10 years and have seen firsthand how brilliant his insights are. So it's a real joy and a privilege to welcome not only my guest today, but also a great friend and valued colleague. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thanks for embarrassing me about all my prep.
Well, I know just how thorough you are. So what I want to start with, first of all, is we've been working together for 10 years or so now, and I know your deep understanding of neuroscience has always been impressive. What was it that drew you into starting to study more about the brain so you can understand more about how you were helping people become even better?
I think I'm my own case study. I struggled for a long, long time feeling outside of normality, so kind of not quite fitting in. So I chose a traditional career path, and when other people seemed to be going along with the flow of things, there was always something not quite sitting comfortably with me. So I became a bit of a human petri dish to understand what was going on. And that, through, you know, very, very small insights at the very early ages of my career, began a deep and long-lasting nerdy love with behavior and brains. I consider myself a nerd about brains. You know, at a biological level, I just think it's the most miraculous thing on the planet. I genuinely do. I look at fMRI scans of brains and think they're beautiful beyond imagination. And the more I researched, even in a lay term, about the human brain, the more I became in love with it and fascinated about it. And then when I began to make some really serious connections between what the biology is inside our schools to how that impacts on what people say and what people do, everything just slotted into place. It just seemed to, you know, now it feels like I've got the keys to the car. I've got the keys to Pandora's box. It's like, so now I understand why, at first, why I did the things that I did and why I didn't feel that I wanted to go along with things. But more importantly, now those simple tools, I can help people understand it. It's just one of those wonderful things that the human brain didn't come with a user manual. And regardless of whatever manuals are out there, they get really, really complicated. So when we understand some of these really simple steps that sit behind it, a lot of things become very easy. And people feel out of control of their psychology when actually we do have a huge amount of influence over it. So it's from a lay interest, it's become my job, my passion, and it consumes me. So it's just a joy to be part of these processes.
I love the description of you being a human petri dish.
Well, I think you've got to start with yourself, really. I mean, most of the best researchers have done that. But it was me. You know, I wanted to understand why my internal dialogue wasn't the same as everybody else's. You know, we've all probably had those out-of-body experiences where you sit in a meeting and you watch everyone else as if they're telepathic. They all seem to be agreeing with each other. And I far too often felt on the outside of it.
Yeah.
And it led me to go to some very dark places about myself. I lost my confidence, full of self-doubt, all sorts of things like that. And it wasn't useful. It wasn't healthy. And then didn't seem to be anybody who was prepared to sit down and talk to me like a human being and to understand them, you know, because it's complicated and because nobody wants to break anybody any further. You find that nobody really wants to talk to people about what's going on under the hood. I mean, even today with wellness and mindfulness, we're still not good at talking to each other about what's going on inside our minds.
What was the first thing? So having started your experiment with the human petri dish and you started the reading, what was the first insight that you took a practical benefit from that you thought, oh, I can grab that and I can use that?
Internal reflection. I started with Myers-Briggs in my old organization, and they kind of put everybody like battery hens through Myers-Briggs, and I liked it because it made me feel good. But then as I started going a little bit deeper, as you know, I'm a nerd, so I don't just take the report. I want to know what sits behind the report. And it felt a little bit like a really expensive horoscope. It said all the right words, but they were artfully vague, I think is the phrase. So I wanted to get into it, and the thing that I got out of it was reflection, really thinking about things. So as an introvert that came out of my Myers-Briggs, I'm a massive introverted thinker. My external dialogue is ridiculously slow to what's going on inside here. My brain's running at a million miles an hour, so the words are really slow. But there's a huge amount of stuff going on behind, and I realised that was what was going on in meetings. While everyone else was leaping into doing the talking, I was doing all the talking on the inside, and then just found it really difficult to kind of segue my view into meetings. But what it taught me two things was the importance of going inside and reflecting. So having those conversations inside my head. I mean, when I was 16, 17, 18, I'd probably been locked up saying that I enjoy talking to myself inside my head. And in the 21st century, that's actually what we advocate. You know, talking therapy is better than any drug. So slowing things down and feeling comfortable having a conversation inside my head about, well, what does that mean to me? How do I feel about that? How do I think about that? And then doing more of the study, the second discipline it taught me was that the world is full of very superficial twaddle. So we're in a rush. So actually, we just want a really quick answer. And so many so-called experts will tell you it just is. And a lot of people go, okay, and they move on. As someone who's fascinated by it, I think, and I've found it's worth just scratching the surface and going, is that really true? What's going on? I am not a neuroscientist of any caliber. You know, I understand it and I'm close to it, but regards to the detail and the depth of knowledge that the profession has, I'm not there. But even the limited bit of knowledge that I've gotten and the breadth of people that I've read about has taught me to just slow things down. Don't take anything at face value and recognize that the human condition wants us all to be in the same pot. So, you know, we want a one size fits all, but then we've discovered, and it's through every single piece of research, every single brain is different, just like everybody's metabolism is different. Mm. So it's kind of, I sit on the sidelines going, well, that's bonkers then, isn't it? So how can you create a diet for every single person on the planet, knowing that every single person is very, very different?
Yeah.
And I understand that we need to make it simple, and that's my job is to make the complex really simple, not so that it puts people into a bag that says that's your type, therefore go and do things. It just gives them an easier way to navigate themselves.
So one question I have for you is, how do you detach yourself from your own problems to look at yourself objectively to solve those problems? So you don't see a cast or a reaching in sort of tuning itself, do you? First of all, did you face that challenge? And if you did, how do you overcome that? Because it's quite a, I certainly find that challenge when I'm really angry and I got to calm down. No, I'm not going to calm down because I'm angry, but I know I need to calm down, but I'm angry. So how do you deal with it? How do you divorce yourself from that challenge?
I don't think there's a formula, Mike. It's an interesting one. It was a struggle at first, because it's kind of like trying to stop the wind when you're in a whirlwind. But the more you do it, the better you get at it.
Right.
And the thing that I learned the most was the person you see today is successful in one area, but actually I tried loads of things that were a bloody disaster. I always was fascinated by people on the London Underground who could read books or actually meditated on the Underground, because I was so fascinated by other people. It was like a target-rich environment. I couldn't understand how you could even read a book. I mean, your hands are wobbling all over the place. So I did some fringe things, and one of the things that, and not to demean meditation, I found it a struggle. Really, really found it a struggle to do it. When everyone else has said, I meditate, I just couldn't do it because the internal chatter in my head just wouldn't go away. And regardless of what book I read or who I was working with, they never taught me how to stop the chatter. Until one real wonderful person came to me and said, you're struggling with your internal dialogue, aren't you? And I was like, yeah, there's noise out here, so it's a loud environment, and then there's noise inside, and I can't hear myself, you know, the real voice I want. And he just told me two words: stop fighting. And it was, he said, if you fight the sound coming in, it will get larger. So it's kind of like doing this, that it just makes it louder. Embrace it, allow the sound in, but just don't pay any attention to it. And that's how I learned to separate myself. It's not trying to stop what's going on. It's recognizing that it's going to go on anyway. And I just don't have to pay attention to it. So you can kind of like split yourself away from it and leave that internal dialogue flowing away, and then just pick like a stream, just pick out the bits that are useful. Just go, oh, that's interesting. What does that mean? Rather than going for the full bore of the stream. So it's always going to go on. It's something that, you know, I've just learned to, you know, fall in love with. It's, you know, I've got lots of thoughts about lots of things. It's just that 99% of them aren't that useful.
I'm going to ask you a closed question now that I know the answer to, but it's just, I just want to open up the possibility. So can people change?
Absolutely.
And what is your, so if you're talking to someone who is, because we're going to be talking about habits very shortly, if you're talking to someone who is in a way of being that doesn't support them, and they can't seem to break, they're on those twin tracks on the railroad, and they're going down, and it's a straight line, and they can see where they want to go, but they can't get there because they're on those tracks. What can you say to someone to convince them to say, yes, despite the fact it feels rigid, it feels solid, it feels permanent, you can change? What is the encouragement that you would give to someone in that situation?
At a biological level, our cells are renewing. And some of the latest research this year from neuroscience is that your brain is remapping itself every hour. So some really interesting things that, so the brain you have today is not the brain you had 16 years ago. So many people have lumped themselves into an identity that said, because I wasn't successful at school, I will never be successful. Well, the brain that sits inside your skull isn't the brain that failed your exams. It's renewed itself completely. So just at that level, if your very structures of who you think you are changing at such a rapid state, then to say that I'm the same person as I was, you know, a year ago is a lie. So it's just a belief problem. The thing that's getting in the way is that change is difficult. If it wasn't difficult, then we'd be changing all the time. And we know at an evolutionary and a survival level, changing constantly is not a great thing. So, and then we're going to get into it with habits. Our habits are there to help us survive. But breaking habits means, by that very definition, I'm changing a survival strategy. And that makes us scared. It makes us scared intellectually, emotionally, and right the way down to our reptilian complex. So that's what stops people. It's not the capability. It's the fear. It feels clunky. It feels uncomfortable. It's scary. But if you can get through that, if you can protect yourself from that fear and rationalize it and put things in place, change is absolutely possible.
So just explain what the evolutionary survival biological mechanism that actually is trying to hold us in our situation that resists the change. What's going on there?
So we evolved, you know, there's been a 35 million year process of evolution. 3.5 million years ago, life was kind of binary. You know, there were things that were going to take you off the planet and things that would keep you on the planet. So our brain has got an overriding principle that is to, we call it approach and avoid now, but basically it was, if something is threatening, it's going to hurt me, it's going to kill me, stay away from it. And if it's going to make me stay around for a bit longer and it might feel nice, then we'll do a little bit more about it. So it's quite a binary choice. Your brain at its deepest level is basically saying, by choosing this behavior, will it be nice and keep me alive, or will it be horrible or take me off the planet? That's it. Mm. And that still operates. So, you know, 3.5 million years, and we've taken most of the threats off the planet, but the same thing is so deep down in our brain structure that it overrides everything. So every single situation that you find yourself in, or even imagine, your oldest complex in your brain is basically saying, is that going to be, do we need to approach that, or do we need to avoid it? And coupling in with that is that we need to be energy savvy. So This piece of kit uses a huge amount of energy, just taking care of business that you don't need to take care of. You know, if you strapped a Cray computer to keeping a heart going and temperature and everything that your brain's doing, it's an enormous draw on all of your energy. We haven't really bottomed it out, but we reckon about 30% of the calories that you consume go straight into your brain. And if you're doing deep thinky stuff, you know, when you get at the end of a long thought process, you kind of go, oh, my God, that's why you're tired. So your brain needs to save as much energy as possible. And that's where habits come in. They're a simple way of applying tried and tested survival techniques that, you know, you just, this works. So just make it as simple as possible so that we don't have to burn too much brain energy just in case we need to do something else. So they're there for, so people, habits get a bad press. And when we were talking about this in the first instance, there was a question that came up for me that said, how many habits do you think you've got? And I asked a few people, and most people kind of go, you know, between 20 and 50. Well, regardless of whatever answer you've got there, there's probably 1,000 more than you've thought of, because you can really only think of the ones that you're conscious of. Right. By definition, a habit is subconscious, so you don't know you've got it. You have a habit about cleaning your teeth. You have a habit about which hand you sign your autograph with, but you don't consciously think about them. Habits get a bad press because they only seem to come into our consciousness because we label them as bad. For every bad habit you've got 1,000 good ones that have kept you on the planet. And they're not really bad. At some point, they served a purpose for you to have even gone through the process of making them into a habit. So they've probably just passed their sell-by date. They're no longer, you know, you've changed, your environment's changed, and the strategy that you once used probably just isn't as useful anymore.
It's really interesting to hear that, because what's going through my mind at the moment is, okay, well, what's the definition of a habit? Now, for me, if I think about habits in the context of productivity, I think of it's a behavior that is repeatable, and is repeatable easily and often without thought. So there's no challenge to the behavior. So getting out of bed in the morning at a certain time every day is a habit. There's no challenge. The alarm goes off, and I'm just thinking about myself. So when the alarm goes off early for me, I get up and I get out every single time. There's nothing that keeps me. Now, there was a time when the alarm would go off and I wouldn't get out of bed, or I wouldn't even set the alarm. I'd just stay there, and it was like I wasn't getting up. But so my behavior has changed, so it's automatic. So in the context you're talking about there, you're talking about some of the things that are so deep in us. So for example, I'm blinking at the moment, and that must be an habitual thing that's there that I'm doing without thinking about it. That's a subconscious thing. So can you give a definition of how you would describe a habit?
For me, a habit is something that you consciously chosen. So right. Some things like blinking, they're reactions. So just because it happens at a subconscious level, the best definition, if you fancy a good long read, is Robert Sapolsky. You know, he talks about genetics and all DNA. But so you've got reactions in order to keep the pipes flowing and keep everything going in your house, in your body. But habits are things that where life has presented us with a situation and we have a choice to make about how we deal with it. And the choice that we make leads to a reward, or leads to unfavorable situations. So there is a cognitive process that creates what you would call a habit as opposed to an instinct or a reaction. A lot of it happens, it's kind of in between conscious and unconscious. We register it ever so slightly, but your brain is so incredibly and exquisitely wired to just build habits anyway. It kind of goes, yeah, we'll have a bit of that, and starts the process without you even getting on with it. There's some wonderful stuff and loads of quotes about, because the only part of our brain that we really have, you know, random access to is our conscious brain. It's a teeny tiny part of it. I was at the Neuro Leadership Summit a couple of weeks ago, and Rock had a brilliant quote. It's not accurate in any way, but it's wonderful in that if you imagine that your conscious brain's about 3 cubic feet, your unconscious brain's the Milky Way.
Really? Big, that difference.
Yeah, it's massive. The potential and everything that's going on in there. But because the only part that we're in is the conscious bit, we seem to think that cognitive thing is the major part of our brain activity, when it's absolutely not.
Right. So whenever I'm talking about the subconscious and conscious, I've normally got one of those pointers with the laser pointers. I normally point it at the wall and say, that's your conscious mind, the wall is your subconscious. But I didn't realize that it might even be as vast as that. So we've looked at what a habit is then. So where I want to get to by the end of this conversation is, what can someone do to take something that they're not currently doing, that they know if they were to choose to do it, it would add value to their life, whether that be stopping smoking or whether in context of we're talking about productivity, a productive habit, what do they need to do in order to make sure that they can get that, so it then becomes, in however long it takes, a permanent part of their behaviours? That's where I want to get to. So in unpacking that, what do we need to know first to understand so that we can make that happen?
So the process of habit creation or habit change is really simple. So your brain is constantly scanning the environment. So every second it's going there, and it's looking for cues, it's looking for triggers, it's looking for antecedents. And, you know, at an evolutionary level, it was that binary thing. Is this a bad thing or is this a good thing? So we've got some programming that anything that looks green or yellow, we automatically will avoid it. Because we follow those kind of signals. So snakes with yellow flashes at the side of their heads and frogs that are yellow are generally not to be licked. So we've got that kind of pre-programmed intelligence, but the world is full of stimuli. So you're looking around. So in the lingo of habits, you're looking for a cue. So something will trigger you. It will grab your attention and it will begin a process of saying, aha, I'm paying attention to that now, and I'm about to apply my decision-making as to what I'm going to do about it.
So if we come back to my getting out of bed, we're talking basically the trigger is the alarm.
The alarm, yeah.
Right, okay.
Absolutely. It's one of those wonderful things that people keep saying, oh, you know, I've got to create a sophisticated thing. No, the world is laden with it, you know. The fact that the sky is blue is a trigger for some people to want to go out walking, or if it starts to rain, they'll say, well, therefore I'm not. It's if we can get more creative and more open about the wealth of triggers that we've got, you begin to understand that each of those, consciously or subconsciously, is triggering a behavior. So we work out what the cue is. So what is it that we're going to do? So if it's smoking, it's not the act of smoking that makes you smoke. There is a thought, or there is a feeling, or is there an urge that says, I need a cigarette now. So what are the cues that make you go down that path? Because you don't do it when you're asleep, you don't do it when you're eating, you don't do it when you're in the shower. And so it's that something in your environment, internal or external, triggers a thinking process with you that says, I need a cigarette. And again, you know, it could be anything. A lot of smokers are social smokers. So what they'll notice is they don't necessarily want to have a cigarette, but they notice that other people or their friend has gone. That means, therefore, I will go. It could be a feeling, so they could feel overwhelmed. They could feel that, you know, the to-do list is just getting here, and all they need to do is they want some calm. So they just notice that things are feeling a little bit full and they need to take the pressure off, so they just go for a cigarette. So the art really is recognizing that there is a trigger and finding that trigger. that trigger then leads to a response. So what is your patterned response? What's the habit? What is it that you do? And for the you'd love this one, Mike, because you can actually process what people do. So they'll do this and they'll do that and they'll do the other.
Brilliant.
Yeah. it's just all there. So there'll be kind of a chain reaction that says, okay, well, the first thing I do is this, and then I do that, and then I do that, and then I do that, and then I do that. So you've got a whole process called the behavior. And then at the end of that, there needs to be a result. A reward, and that's what it is. So something triggers it. We go and do a process, or say something, or do something, and at the end of it, we will receive something. So we'll either receive a reward, which feels good, or we'll get slapped, or we'll get stung, which feels bad, and then that feeds back into so the next time. So a lot of people are afraid of wasps. So you'll see them do that. They'll do the dance in a pub, and that's because they've been stung before. And they go, these things equal pain. So that's what triggers this reaction that they've got of flapping their arms, thinking that it's going to do. And actually, realistically, flapping your arms in front of a wasp's face, particularly in autumn, is not a great strategy, but we still do it.
Right. And what's the payoff there? So when you're talking about the payoff there, so I was thinking the two things. First of all, my own, I get up at very early, ridiculously early, by some people's standards, but it suits me. I get up, I make my way to my alarm clock, which is always outside the room. So that's just a way I make sure I distance myself from the bed. And then I go through my routine, my morning routine. So I'm trying to think what my payoff is, because I know it's good for me. But I'm trying to think, it's only a couple of hours later when I've done my routine where I go, well, that was good. I'm glad I got up. Is that my payoff?
It is, yes. The easiest way to do it is imagine not doing it. Imagine
the day you don't
make. What do you now feel? You feel loss.
Right.
What is it you've missed? It's not the discomfort of getting up. It's not the discomfort of doing it. It's I think the best way, or the simplest way, is to put it, because it's going to be different for everybody. But if you consider a rock scarf model.
Right.
It gives you a sense of status. So if in your house,
just summarize the model first for people who don't understand it, and then explain that.
The model is SCARF. So these are how we manage social threat. So between threat and reward, we feel it in five areas. So we can feel threatened or rewarded in terms of status, how we feel about ourselves. So a bit of ego and a bit of self-worth. Certainty, so predictability, completion. A is for autonomy, so the degree of choice that we have. R is for relatedness, so empathy and trust, so about getting people to align with us. And then F is for fairness, so our sense of fairness, which is ever so slightly skewed in our favour. So getting up early, if you get up early in a household of people who get up late, you might have the bragging rights because you get to the kitchen first, you get the best, you know, it's the early bird stuff. So right. You may have status that says, aha, because I get up early, I can make all the phone calls, or I get the best bread. So it could fulfill your status. It could fulfill your certainty, because while you're awake, you are in control of things.
Right.
It could give you a sense of autonomy, because you choose to set your alarm. So when everyone else is conforming to, you know, we get up at 10 o'clock, you go, no, I'm going to be different and I will choose when I get up. It could be that there's a club of people that, you know, it's a very crowded room and there's just an elite few people who meet very early in the morning, and they have that telepathy where they just go, yeah, different gang, aren't we?
Yeah.
So there's that kind of thing. Or it could be something about fairness, you know, is that you just want more daylight. It's going to be different for everybody. But the simplest answer is imagine not doing it. And then what is it that you miss out on? Would you feel uncomfortable? For me, knowing you for the last few years, I would say that there is a level of certainty. I think your routine is something that you value completing. So you do everything to the nth degree. You don't do anything, you know, at 80%. You go full out, and it's completion. If you only did it at 80%, you'd be twitching, you'd be fidgeting, you'd be going, I'm not quite. So it's that sense of completion. You know, I used to have a thing where I would crack my knuckles, and if one finger cracked, I've just done it now, and I've got to do all of them now. So I used to think it was a sense of fairness, but it's not. It's just a sense of completion.
Right.
And you know, the reason that I read even the most disastrous books from cover to cover is not because I want to get knowledge. It's because I need to read the whole book.
Yeah.
So it's completion.
It's interesting. When you were talking about the scarf model there, having heard you talk about it many times, I was thinking, well, I could see how some of those, but I wasn't quite sure where relatedness comes in. But as soon as you said it, it reminded me of things I've seen. So Jocko Willink, who is an ex-Navy SEAL, a real badass mofo. I think he's got the guy with the big neck. And amazing guy, brilliant books on discipline, on leadership. And he talks about getting up early, and he gets up at 4:45, and he's got this great podcast. And there's lots of people tweeting their watch when it's showing 4:45, because saying, look, I'm part of the club. And so when you said that,
yeah,
that's suddenly...
And he doesn't have to invite you into it. You just turn around. And so we replicate everybody else's habits.
Yeah.
You know, people say, well, I'm doing a Covey thing, or I'm doing a Jocko thing. And Jocko doesn't know you exist, but because you're doing it at the same point in your head, you're part of Jocko's gang.
Yeah, yeah. That makes complete sense. So so we're driven. So there's the benefit that you're talking about. So you've got the trigger, you've got the behavior, and you've got the payoff. The payoff could be either the gaining of something great or the avoidance of something bad.
Or the avoidance of something uncomfortable,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and a lot of it boils down to drugs. You know, all of your reactions and all your sensations are because you're getting different endorphins and neurochemicals, you know, primarily dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin. They're the big feel-good ones. But it could be the avoidance of it. So if you get up early because you want to be the person who's the best prepared, it might be an avoidance strategy because you don't want to feel embarrassment in the meeting.
Right. Right.
So you either get more of what you do want, or you avoid what you don't want, and that's a reward.
Right. So the anatomy, which you've laid out beautifully, trigger, behavior, and reward. So what about the setting up of something like that? Because if you look at my morning routine, it's very well drilled now. I can describe it. It happens every morning, almost to the point that there's meditation, there's exercises, press-ups, there's cold showers and stuff. I can more or less set my clock by the time, because I've been doing it for so long now.
Yes.
So there's a degree of regularity there. There's a degree of permanence there. When I first started doing that, I had to build up to that. So what would you recommend someone who's going to take one habit that might be productivity? Let's say it is, for example, planning your day the night before, which is one of the things that I highly recommend. If they were going to start doing that, with what you understand about habits, what would you advise someone in terms of the trigger, behavior, reward, and then the development of the permanence of that?
It starts small. We're massive speed freaks. We want everything. We want the whole world, and we want it now. And in order to do this, if you understand the process, do the smallest things, but just do them really, really well. So the first thing is to recognize or set up a cue. So if it's a new habit that you want, then set up a cue. So for you set an alarm. So set a trigger that says, right, now I need to switch on and do the habit. And then you need to break down the habit into very, very simple steps. So don't just say, I'm going to go to the gym and get fitter. You say, no, I'm going to get up and I'm going to put my trainers on and I'm going to put my kit on and I'm going to go and do 10 press-ups and I'm going to go and do X amount. The more clear and specific those small steps are, the easier it will be to embed it.
I just need to throw in my favorite quote now, which you know what's coming. and I'm going to put myself on screen for this because resistance is often the lack of clarity. Chip and Dan Heath. Okay, resistance
Absolutely.
Is often lack of the clarity. So I just had to indulge in that for a second, Steve, because you know it's my favourite quote.
I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, you and I have kind of had some really heated arguments about the degree of clarity that people go to. But yeah, make it really, really clear and make it simple. Mm. You know, but give yourself some slack. You know, the best diets aren't the all-encompassing ones. They're ones that just say, well, I'm just going to eat a little bit less. That's it. Leave it at that. You know, and once you're eating a little bit less, then build and do something else. You know, eat healthier stuff, but a bit less of it. So it's break it down into manageable chunks. You know, the art to creating a habit is repetition. You've got to get it into something where you've drilled yourself so many times that you just can't imagine not having it. And in order to do that, it's got to be something that is easily accessible in your brain at all times. The biggest enemy to anybody learning a new habit is allowing life to get in the way. So, you know, if you're going to say that I'm going to go out and I'm going to run 100 yards every single day, but it's raining today, then that's not really what it is. So you've got to kind of negotiate every possible opportunity. So the simpler the activity, the more resilient it will be to life's nuances.
And I think that's a really good way of looking at it. If I think about my habits, I wake up, I get out of bed at 5 a.m. every morning, and yeah, I'm ready to work by 7:30 because of everything that I've done. And that's taken me 9, 10, maybe a year to get to that point. And I remember the first thing was just getting out of bed.
Yeah.
That was the first thing. And then it was a case of, right, learning to put my alarm clock outside as a way of definitely getting out of bed. And what started off as like a 7 o'clock, then became a 6:45, then came a 6:30. Yeah. And then slowly what happened is that my morning routine extended. So 7:30 was always the starting work time. But then because I was getting up early, I was able to put more meditation in or more exercise in or more yoga in. So it did build up over time.
So you actually built in a reward mechanism into it.
Yeah.
So it's this... It's worth thinking a lot about it and breaking down this bigger thing into lots of smaller keystone habits. So, you know, just in using your example, the first keystone habit is getting up better.
Yeah.
So just being better at getting up. So most people think, well, it's just setting an alarm, isn't it? No, it's not. I know far too many people who set the alarm and then it's snooze after snooze after snooze. You created an art, you created a habit of getting up more effectively, even to the point that you moved the alarm clock outside. You know, I was the same in learning how to get up, is don't lay in bed. As soon as the alarm goes off, as you move your arm to switch the alarm off, feet should be getting on the floor.
Yeah.
And then there's no way you're going to get back. And then I incorporated having a shower. You know, so my reward was I want to get up because I enjoy being in the shower, because at the end of the shower, I'm going to have a really nice coffee. So, you know, the whole getting up process, where some people see it as punitive because, oh my God, I've got to get dressed because I go to work. Well, actually, before I go to work, which isn't, you know, as you know, I love it anyway, so I'm enjoying it. But, you know, before I get to do that, I'm going to have a really nice shower. I'm going to be able to watch the news. I'm going to have a coffee. You know, there's a lot of reward that builds into it. So, again, if you see the three stages, craft each of the stages. So really good, simple triggers, break down and clear steps. So if this happens, then I will do that. And then at each step, how will I maximize the reward sensation? So, you know, being grateful, seeing all those tiny successes that you get, will just embed it. Because the key to getting it down from your cognitive brain into your instinctive brain is rigorous repetition, deliberate practice again and again and again and again until you just can't not do it.
One of the things that I found that works really well, and I'd be interested to know if there's a neuroscience element to this, is that putting or removal of friction that's going to prevent you doing that. So, for example, for me, one of the first things I did was move my phone, which is where my alarm clock is, outside the room. So when it went off, I had to get out of bed because I couldn't trust myself to go snooze or stop. Now, I've got an iPhone. I don't know if you looked at the alarm clock on an iPhone, but the snooze button is that big and the stop button is that big. So, I mean, there's some practical stuff there. It's just encouraging me to snooze. So is there anything neuroscientific about the removal of those barriers? So, for example, if you're going to exercise in the morning when you get up, you put your trainers and your running kit next to your bed, so that's the first thing you stumble over that you get into, so you're more likely to be ready. Is there anything neuroscientific going on about those sort of things?
Not specifically. They will just go into the brain thing. But if you understand that your brain is a slave for the easiest, then the tactic is anything that's difficult that creates cognitive load, your brain's going to kind of go, oh, not so sure about that one. Let's go for the easy bit. You know, it's kind of the whole place where we are with unhealthy eating. It's far easier to eat a Mackie D now than go and get a salad. Because Mackie D, you can have it now and you've got carbs and sugars and it's great and we'll do the diet tomorrow, because that takes a bit of thought, it takes a bit of preparation. So you know what your own barriers are. So
can I just say something? Other brands of burger are available as well. Oh, we're not the BBC. We're not the BBC. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, make it easy for yourself. You know, if you talk to me about your routine of laying out your clothes and things, and, you know, as a parent, I want a clear floor, because at 3 o'clock in the morning, if I'm stumbling into the children's bedroom, I really don't want my trainers in the way. But, you know, you just make things easy for yourself. If you are a slave to the big button, then yeah, absolutely move the button.
Yeah.
If you find it difficult to open your eyes and you can't find your gym kit, well, lay it out. You know, it's been proven with firefighters that they systematically undress so that, just by autopilot, by moving their legs out, their legs are dropping straight into their trousers, bang, and they can move on. So it's make it important enough for you to do these disciplines. If you don't connect with a value, you'll just go, I'll do it in the morning. So you've got to connect it to something that makes it really, really important to you, that you go, no, before I go to sleep, I am going to do this. And then, the making it easy is about either make it really rewarding at every single step so that you're kind of slavishly craving the next reward, or just get rid of the blockages.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in a group of people who are constantly berating you and making you feel bad about your diet or what you do, well, the simplest thing is don't hang around with them.
I accept your apology, by the way.
That's what you're welcome, pal.
All the grief you've given me.
That's a guilt trip.
Sorry, that was a joke.
just remove the blockages. Yeah. And this is the corrosive effect, because it takes a lot of practice to make it work, but it only takes one knock to make it fragile. I tell a story about my hero, Johnny Wilkinson. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I'd love to believe it's true, because I think he's brilliant. Is that when he was at Newcastle Falcons, he would take 100 kit. When the training had finished, he'd go to the left-hand side of the pitch and he would take 100 kicks from the left-hand edge of the pitch and stick it through the pins. And then he'd go to the right-hand side of the pitch and he'd take 100 and he'd knock it through. And if he'd kicked 99 and the 100th didn't make it, he started again. Mm. And that's the same thing with your psychology towards habits. It is a pattern of success. And for every success, your failures will knock you deeper. So, you know, you can do it 13, 14, 15 times, and the day you get it wrong, you're actually knocking yourself backwards. So it's building in that resilience that says we can go. And some of that is actually being kind to yourself. You know, it's not a failure. It's just a day you didn't do it. So a lot of people will go, I'm going to quit smoking or drinking, or I'm not going to eat chocolate or something like that, and they fall off the wagon and they have chocolate, and it's like, that doesn't mean you failed. It just means that yesterday you didn't do what you said you'd do, so get back on it. But people take the F word really seriously, and then they kind of go into a bit of self-decline, which builds in another success factor for habits, is socializing your habits. Get other people involved. If you join a club and you've got two people that are trying to do the same thing, then you have a mutual bond that says, well, I can't let this person down. So if you exercise with someone else, because then if you don't go, then you will suffer the feeling of guilt for not having gone with them. So you then kind of bully yourself because you don't want the embarrassment. You get up and you go and do it. And the other thing is tell as many people as possible. You know, most people don't care. And they'll pretend to be interested. They go, oh, that's interesting. But one or two people will just keep you on board. They'll, you know, when you ring them after a week, they'll go, how are you doing with your writing a book? You know, you kindly say I've written two books. I've actually started thousands. So to have gotten to the end of actually seeing a physical book is amazing. And I recognized that while people were asking me about my book and asking me about it, I had the energy to go, oh, I need to be able to say something interesting about it. So when people are saying, you know, you'd say, how are you getting on with the book? The one thing I didn't want to say was, I haven't done anything, Mike. I wanted to say, oh, I've written a new chapter. So that kept me going on it. But every time when I've kind of fallen off the wagon, it's actually been the people have stopped talking to me about it. So I just go, well, sure. they're not interested in it, so I won't be interested in it. So there's a huge thing about longevity. So if you've got to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, recognize the fact that you are human and you're fallible, and there will be days when you just don't want to do it. So you either build that into your strategy of saying, I'm not going to do it, you know, ad infinitum every single day. I'm going to allow myself a day off here and a day off there. Or get people around you that will notice when you're not on it, and they'll just go, come on, get back in the saddle. Come on, we're with you. You know, get some cheerleaders on your side. And that's a huge motivator.
What is your advice about creating it long term? So you hear these numbers of 21 days to put a habit in, or 30 days. And then there was some research done where the average was like 67 days. And obviously, I think the simple answer is you do it until, but what does neuroscience say about the ideal time, assuming that you're doing the habit correctly and perfect?
There isn't an ideal, Mike. I wish I could give you an answer.
Right.
The conference or the summit 2 weeks ago said that it can be done in 21 days. It's about the degree, the depth, and the intensity that you do it. So if you want to shorten the timescales, then you've just got to go deeper. You've got to go full out. So I think it's that being cognizant of what you can do. You know, how much can you weigh into this? If you can dedicate hours of a day and huge amounts of concentration and practice, then the likelihood is that you will carve out a habit really, really quickly. It may not stay with you. So you might say, right, so it's kind of like the driving courses that will go, right, I'm going to do a weekend intensive. So you spend a lot of time doing it, but it's that, what are you going to do afterwards? You know, how are you going to build that into your life? So your basic skill set and your basic routines will be embedded in that time, but you've still got to build in a capacity that says, right, without the fully intense, I'm sitting behind the wheel of a car, how can I imagine being behind a car? So you've still got to have this, and normal life will kick in. And it will be different for different people. It will also depend upon the complexity of what it is, the habit that you're building. I mean, if all you want to do is learn to get up early, that's relatively okay. But when you look at your field of being productive is a headline nominalization for probably 1,000 really good practices. So it's kind of go down a little bit and say, actually, which are the five habits that I want to do, and do them one at a time, go full out. And when you're almost automatic with it, then you can move on to the next one. But don't try and do five at once. Learn to get up first. And when you think you've got that one cracked, get up and do something else. And then, and so I remember when my children were learning to swim, and it's amazing that you know, I learned to swim, and I found it quite difficult, but you forget how complex that is. And when you look at people who swim, it's really complicated. There's things to do with your arms. There's things to do with your head. There's things to do with your toes and your feet. And I remember my son really struggled with the butterfly until a coach just broke the entire stroke down into, right, what do you want to do first? And Dan was, you know, I want to do the arms because that's the sexy bit. And he went, okay, well, let's get your arms right. And he never even went in a pool. You know, he turned up with all of his kit and his floats and everything. The guy said, no, don't get changed. We're going to go into a room and we're just going to learn how it feels to get your arms in the right place. And he just did that, you know, hour after hour after hour, left arm, right arm. And then he did the wiggly worm thing with his legs. And so he did it all separately. And then came the day, get in the water and do it all in one go. It was like a drowning starfish, just drowning my numbers. And it was just like, yeah, because actually putting all five habits into one body and trying to get them all to fire at the same time is actually taking a huge amount of bandwidth. So we've got a limited amount of bandwidth in our psychology. So you can dedicate it to getting up. But then when you say, I'm going to get up and I'm going to do something else, that same amount of bandwidth is halved because you've got half on getting up and half on getting something else. And this is where people lose mental energy with their habits, is because they haven't broken it down into the simplest things yet. in order to build this complex thing, what you've got to do is you've got to get your getting up, your first part, into a place where it doesn't tie up any bandwidth. So then you can dedicate the bandwidth onto something else. Sure. If you go, I want to do that and that and that and that and that, something's going to fall off. And that's where we lose our impetus.
That's a beautiful description. And ties in really nicely with my experience of developing my morning routine, is that there's no way I could jump into doing what I do now straight away because I'd be overwhelmed, it'd be too much. But slowly I've nudged the clock back earlier and earlier to get up. I've increased the meditation I do from 5 to 10 to 20 to half an hour. I've increased the number of press-ups I do. I've increased the amount of time in the cold shower. That's a hard one, that is.
Yes, I'm sick.
I'm screaming less in the morning now. So so it's moving forward. Steve, this has been a fascinating insight into the formulation of habits and understanding the neuroscience behind it. We could talk for hours about this. So I'm going to draw to, there are two questions I have left for you. The first question I have for you is, if there was one thing about developing a new habit, regardless whether it's productivity or for health or whatever, what's the one thing you would recommend people keep uppermost in their mind about the development of that habit?
Small and simple. So wherever you start, if you start with your cues, look for the smallest, simplest cue. If you're creating a routine, a behavior, do simple things and be very, very clear about it and simple reward. You know, it doesn't have to be that you're going to buy yourself a new Rolex. It just could be, I feel good at getting out of the bloody shower. You know, it's recognizing small and simple is the fuel that will keep it. So clear, simple, every time.
Fantastic. Where can people find out more about you and the work that you do?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Steve_Marriott. You can find me at steve-marriott.co.uk. Join the conversation. If brains and behavior confuse you, then there's some really good stuff coming in the pipeline in the new year to help you get the best out of things.
Steve, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Peak Performance Productivity Podcast. Being a productive peak performer is about developing strong and long-lasting habits. Get your free habit installation kit from 5minutehabitkit.com right now, where you'll be able to permanently install any habit you choose in under 5 minutes a day with this proven 3-step system. They are surprisingly easy to install with this free kit once you know how. And if you've got just one thing from today's episode that you can use, then please like, share, subscribe, comment, or review to show your appreciation to today's guest. Until next time.